About 2 weeks ago, I finished reading a book titled The Color of War, written by James Campbell. And James has been a guest on this program a couple of times. So this is his third visit, actually. He's a Wisconsin native and resident. He's written many award-winning adventure, travel, environmental, and military history pieces. And his first book, set in Alaska, we were just talking before the show about it. It's called The Final Frontiersman. He followed that up with a stunning book called The Ghost Mountain Boys, about the battle for New Guinea in World War II. And he's back with a gripping book. It's called The Color of War, How One Battle Broke Japan and Another Changed America. And it's kind of two. And James, welcome, by the way.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Great to have you back. And I really love this book. It was heart-wrenching sometimes. It's just terrifying in other places. There were times that I felt kind of ashamed.
Yeah.
For our country.
Yeah, The Sins of Our Nation is one of the chapter titles.
Yeah.
The legacy of slavery lasted for a long time, or perhaps lasts still.
Yeah. So you talk about how this book evolved for you.
Well, it was a long, long labor of love, as I said. It took me over 3 years to write. There were times when I didn't think I would ever finish it.
Yeah.
When I was researching the last book, The Ghost Mountain Boys, after I'd made my trek, retracing the footsteps of the Ghost Mountain Boys across New Guinea, I was recuperating in Port Moresby, and I met two professors from the University of Port Moresby who asked me if I knew anything about a group of engineers called the 96 Engineers. It was an African-American engineering group that built roads and wharfs and piers and airstrips all over New Guinea, and they suffered mightily from dysentery, malaria, dengue fever, etc. And I said, no, I know nothing about it. So I came home and I found a book, which was a compilation of letters and diary entries by the white captain of the 96 Engineers, and I found nothing else. And I realized that had that book not been put together, that I'd know nothing about the experience of these African-American engineers. So what I did is I researched a little bit more to try to find a record, both oral and written, of black contributions to World War II, and it was really sparse, and I thought, What a huge omission!
Yeah, really, what a huge omission! And so you talk about that in the context of several young black men who had enlisted in the Navy.
Yeah,
and thought they were going to go to battle, which is what they wanted. They called it the right to fight.
They wanted to fight and die with their white comrades,
and instead wound up in Port Chicago Naval Ammunitions Depot, not in Chicago, but in California.
Yeah, just 40 miles northeast of San Francisco. Yeah, I follow a number of white Marines to Saipan and a number of black sailors to the Port Chicago Naval Ammunition Depot, and they had dreams of serving aboard a destroyer or battleship, and when they arrived at Port Chicago and realized that they would be loading ammunition ships that were bound for the Pacific in the invasion of the Central Pacific, they were pretty disillusioned. They had never been trained to handle ordnance, depth charges, and high capacity shells, and they suffered there.
And we'll get into that. So that's one part of the book. Mm-hmm. That's one of the stories. The other story is the battle for Saipan, which was Donald Miller, historian, called it as important a victory over Japan as the Normandy invasion was in victory over Germany.
Yeah, we've heard a lot about the great battles of the Pacific, Guadalcanal, Peleliu, Okinawa, Tarawa, but very few people know what happened on Saipan, and in my opinion, it was the pivotal battle of the Central Pacific. So I kind of merged these two stories, what I call the good war and the good war's ugly underbelly, which was racism in America. And it's part of the World War II narrative that we often hear or that we hear very little about.
And obviously that the theme of that book is an important theme is that lack of opportunities for Black Americans in military service at that time. What were the restrictions? I mean, they couldn't fight.
They were not allowed to bear arms. So it was for African American soldiers and that, you know, anyone in the armed forces, it was a powerful symbol of injustice and a reminder of their status as second-class citizens in the United States.
Yeah. And they, and in fact, it was World War II when they were first sort of allowed into the Navy, was it not?
Yeah, the World War II, the lone training camp for Black recruits was in Waukegan, Illinois, so just south of the state line. And that's where all Black recruits were trained.
So we'll get into that some more, but I also want to turn back to the Battle of Saipan, and I really enjoyed reading about, you have, I don't know, probably 10 major people that you kind of carry through, and the one that caught my attention probably the most was Frank Borta?
Frank Borta, yeah, who, as a matter of fact, just died on Memorial Day.
Oh, he did?
Yeah, yeah. He was down in Houston at his son's wedding and had been ill and happened to die down there.
But he started, he enlisted in the Navy, or In the Marines, yeah. I should say. He had to lie about his age.
Right, he was 16. They called him Chick, as in spring chicken, and he hadn't even shaved. He begged his mother to lie about his age. His mother complied. And his father's reply to him when he realized that his son Frank was going to be in the Marines, he said, "I knew the war was going bad, but not badly enough to take, you know, my 16-year-old boy." So can you imagine a 16-year-old boy, 17, when he went into battle on Tarawa? Can you imagine him facing a situation like that?
Yeah. James Campbell, our guest today, he is the author of The Color of War. Great to have him along today. Part of that, about half his book deals with the battle for Saipan. The other half deals with Black enlisted men during World War II and their treatment. And certainly I enjoyed it, reading it very, very much. I know you will too. You may be familiar with the battle for Saipan or had relatives who were involved in it. How'd you learn about it? Does it surprise you that Black enlisted men were treated so poorly? Well, why or why not for that? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or go to my Facebook page. You can post there at The Larry Mueller Show. We would love to hear from you. Maybe you could describe for us, Let's talk about the Black men who were working in that Port Chicago Naval Ammunition Depot. Describe a day. What a day was like. I mean, it was horrific.
Yeah, well, they were loading ordnance onto ammunition ships, as I said, bound for the Central Pacific. They were loading ordnance that they were completely unfamiliar with. In the prelude to the invasion of Saipan, the Port Chicago was running 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They were loading 10 tons of ordnance per hour. They were loading dozens of different kinds of ordnance. They were loading high projectile shells loaded with Torpex, which was sensitive to impact and penetration. They were loading, I think, 26,000 tons of ordnance per month. So they were being driven. The white officers, in some cases, encouraged competitions among the loading divisions, which was strongly discouraged. There was no comprehensive loading manual, training manual for any of these men. So in some cases, the white officers knew almost as little as the Black workmen. But many of them were working in the hold of a ship. Can you imagine 30 feet down in a hold of a ship working 8 to 10 hours a day? And the naval ammunition depots were hotbeds of discontent because there was no opportunity for promotion for the black sailors, so they resented that.
It was just horrific to read about what they had to do every single day. Unbelievable. We have some callers on the line. You may want to join in, too, again at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Joanne in Verona, let's turn to you. Hi, Joanne. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking that call. I was just curious when the battle for St. Pants took place. In relationship to the Battle of Lady Gulf?
Okay. Well, the Battle of Saipan was from June 15th of 1944,
okay.
And it was officially declared over on July 17th of 1944.
Oh, okay, that's what I was wondering. Mm-hmm. And then the Marianas, the Great Turkey Shoot?
Yeah,
that
was part of the Battle of Saipan.
Oh, it was? Okay,
yes, it was. It happened just west of Saipan in the Philippine Sea.
Okay. My dad was on board the USS St. Lo, which had the distinction of being the first carrier to be sunk by a kamikaze.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
And we get together, as his daughter, we get together for their reunions once a year to this day. And the reason I'm calling about this is there were two black men on board ship, and both are deceased now.
Mm-hmm.
And both were in the water when the ship was sunk. And it was amazing that they were never thought of as by color. Yet when one of the men were pulled aboard the raft, he was amazed that a white person, a Caucasian person, would save his life.
Yeah,
you know,
that's interesting.
And it was amazing.
Many of the white Marines, black Marines, were sent to the front lines for the first time on Saipan. And many of the white Marines I asked them how they felt when they saw black Marines next to them. They said, you know, we didn't care. We didn't care what color they were. As long as they fought and they fought bravely, it didn't matter a bit to us.
Yeah.
And that was exactly it. We owe these men and women, but we owe these men so much.
Yeah.
And I really admire them. We're losing them so fast.
Yeah, we are. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, Joanne, for calling. Appreciate your call very much. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest today, James Campbell, author of The Color of War. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest, James Campbell, author of the book, The Color of War, How One Battle Broke Japan and Another Changed America. Lots of callers online. There's still an open line for you at 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to Joan in Milwaukee next. Hi, Joan. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I just wondered if one of his sources, I haven't heard the whole program, was the book called Marshalling for Justice, which is the history of Justice Marshall's fight as a lawyer for the NAACP for civil rights, including, like the last quarter of the book, rights for black servicemen.
Yeah, it was, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yes. Talk about that, because Thurgood Marshall plays a good role, especially toward the end of your book.
Yeah, he does. On July 17th, 1944, on the day we were celebrating the victory over Japan on the island of Saipan, on the day Tojo resigned, submitted his resignation to Hirohito in Japan for losing the island of Saipan, the Port Chicago Naval Ammunition Depot exploded with one-fifth the explosive fury of the bomb dropped on Hiroshima. And 3 weeks later, the men, by the way, were given no survivor's leaves. The black sailors, the white officers, were given survivor's leave. but they were ordered, actually, that's questionable, but they were, let's say, ordered to load ships again, and 258 of them refused. Ultimately, they were threatened with being put before a firing squad, and 50 of the black sailors held out. They were accused of mutiny and tried before a military court of law. And Thurgood Marshall sat in on the last quarter of the trial and quickly saw that, in his opinion, it was a show trial. And that these men were being railroaded, and wrote the appeal on their behalf. So it was he'd already had a case in front of the Supreme Court, but nevertheless, this was an enormous case for him, and he focused the publicity on the Navy and the evils of the Navy, and, as I said in a chapter, the sins of our nation.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling, Joan. Gene in Oshkosh. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry, and your guest. You took me by surprise. I didn't know you were going to have this guest or this topic, but I have in front of me. I wonder if the guest has read something called Saipan, Suicide Island by Guy Gabaldon.
I have, yeah. Guy Gabaldon, I think.
Yeah.
Yes, I have. And he wrote a book about the Japanese bonsai and the civilian suicides on Saipan at the end of the war.
It's a fascinating island. We've been out there three or four times. My son-in-law was the brown tree snake invasive species person for the Pacific. And we really enjoyed visiting Saipan, but there's an undercurrent, and it's very interesting if you look at it from an economic point of view, because the Japanese still own quite a bit of the land. The Chinese own many of the businesses. There are many, many different races there, but the fact that you brought up this point that there are virtually no black population on the island.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, the United States has a beautiful, beautiful memorial for all the people who had died. Have you seen that memorial?
I have, yeah. I visited Saipan twice when I was researching the book.
And it's...
Yeah, to look across the 3 mile channel, and there's Tinian, and of course we've been on Tinian, mm-hmm. and where the Enola Gay took off and so on.
It's and that memorial is a beautiful memorial, James.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Gene, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to give some others a chance to get in here. But I really appreciate the call. Paul in Bruce, Wisconsin, it's your turn. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I was on the 473rd Infantry Regiment. This was a separate regiment. And toward the close of the war of Italy, I served in Africa and Italy as anti-aircraft. And then they retreaded us into infantry when there were no more German planes. And we were alongside the 442nd, both regiments attached to the 92nd Division. And I just wonder if there was any truth to the rumor that we had that the white officers who were in charge of the 92nd Division transferred the junior officers, the junior black officers out of that division before the 92nd went into battle in the northern part of Italy towards the close of the war. And that's one thing I'd like to know. And I want to thank the 442nd Division, the 442nd Regiment. They saved our neck a few times. And I also hope that we saved theirs. But we never saw a black soldier anywhere near on the battle line, but then we did. We weren't looking either.
Yeah. I wish I could answer that question for you, but I can't. But certainly, the 442nd is, you know, of World War II fame. And the one thing I can say is that, you know, African American servicemen in World War II performed their duties ably and responsibly and with respect. And patriotically, but of course were denied the opportunity for much of the war to fight, which is what they really wanted. And actually, it's what many white soldiers express some resentment that black soldiers were not spilling their blood on the battlefields, but it's exactly what they wanted to do because they equated it with full citizenship in our country.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you very much, Paul, for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 with your questions or comments as we talk with James Campbell today about his book, The Color of War. And Tim in Lodi, we turn to you next. Hi, Tim. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Sure. Mr. Campbell, I have a question for you.
Uh-huh. My hometown.
That is correct. It is your hometown. And my question is, if they had decided at one point to not allow the African Americans to bear arms, what was the change in the war where they decided to start sending them to the front line?
Oh, good question. What was the kind of the turning point?
So. Yeah, that's a great question. Thanks, Lodi. This was not a plant, by the way. On Saipan was actually the first time they sent African Americans into the front lines, and that happened because the casualty rate was so high, 13,000 casualties on Saipan, American casualties, and General Howland Smith, who was in charge of the land invasion, realized that he needed to patch holes in his front lines. So he sent black Marines from ammunition and depot companies into the front lines to fight. But general policy in the armed forces, certainly the explosion at Port Chicago was a catalyst for integration, not only in the Navy, but in general in the armed forces. In July of 1946, the Navy, under James Forrestal, officially integrated, and 3 years after Truman integrated, in Executive Order 9981, the Army integrated, and the Armed Forces, as a matter of fact, became a progressive force for integration in the United States. But much of that was set in motion by Port Chicago. At least that's what I argue in my book.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So was there a ripple effect then beyond the military?
Yeah, there was.
You kind of alluded to that.
Yeah, I did. It was in my epilogue. I mentioned that 3 years before, 10 years before Martin Luther King's civil rights campaign, the Navy integrated completely, and three years before the Little Rock Nine entered the Little Rock Central High School, the last racially segregated unit in the armed forces had been abolished. And all federally controlled schools for the children of servicemen had been desegregated.
Yeah. Beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Tim, for calling. Appreciate it. And Carolyn in Wauwatosa, hi to you. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I have a couple of questions here. I've always been interested in a lot of U.S. history, and if we go back to the Civil War and we look at the integration of African-American troops into the Union forces, wouldn't you think that we would have learned a lesson from their valor and the recognition that they received? And I guess my other question is what role did they play in the World War One? And, you know, we hear mostly about in World War II, the Tuskegee, my dad was in the 8th Air Force, and flew bombing missions and kind of came in at the end, and so the Tuskegee weren't flying across the channel anymore. But what you know, history is supposed to teach us things, and we tend to ignore it a lot.
Yeah, I think that's a great comment. In the notes section of my book, I treat at length the history of black valor in America's wars, from the Revolutionary War to the War of 1812, Civil War. World War One, yes, blacks did serve in World War One, and then the armed forces reinstituted, for what reason, I don't know, reinstituted segregation. And black sailors were chambermaids and dishwashers and bellhops. But I think that the powers that be, that being the Secretary of War, Stimson, Secretary of Navy, Chief of Staff General Marshall, wartime mobilization was difficult enough during World War II, and their excuse or reason or rationale for not integrating was because they thought it would be bad for morale, bad for efficiency, in that it was no time for social experiments. In fact, General George Marshall said that racism and segregation was part of the American fabric since our very inception, and wartime was no time to change that. And the Assistant Secretary of War told Roosevelt to wait until after the war to reform the world or reform America.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Thank you, Carolyn, for calling. And again, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234 with your questions and with your comments as well. That the describe for us a bit about the Japanese approach in Saipan and why it turned into, I mean, I don't think anybody expected to have the kind of mess that.
No. Yeah, it was, the Japanese knew that if they lost Saipan, it was the crucial island as far as they were concerned. Saipan's 1,300 miles from the Japanese islands. They knew if the U.S. captured Saipan and just across the Straits Tinian, that Japan, the home islands, was in reach, were in reach of the B-29 bomber and long-range submarines and aircraft carriers. And when it became apparent that Japan was going to lose the island, the Japanese soldiers staged the largest bonsai charge of the entire war on Saipan, and it was a gruesome, horrible sight, and I interviewed many of the Marines who beat back the bonsai charge, and it haunts them to this day. And one Marine combat correspondent called Saipan the Island of the Dead. And Japan lost 29,500 of its 30,000 soldiers on the island of Saipan, and many of them, after the bonsai charge, who lived, committed ritualistic suicides on the bluffs on Saipan. So it was a terrible place to be.
Tona in Ashland, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I was just wondering if your guest knew if the Navajo code talkers who were stationed in Saipan at the time and that area in the Pacific, if they were ever told by the U.S. government that they were only there as a code and they were ordered to be killed if ever captured, if they were ever told that after the war.
Boy, that's really interesting. I can't answer that, but it strikes me as very plausible that if they were the code talkers and knew all the ultra secret U.S. codes, that if ever they fell into enemy hands, that they would be killed or ordered to commit suicide. Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, as I came to know it, they didn't really realize that they were, the code was their native tongue.
Mm-hmm.
So and it never got broken.
Right.
You know, it was never got found out because only the Navajo knew the Navajo language, and they were used. And the way I understand it, they didn't realize that they would be killed if they were ever, captured.
Mm-hmm. I wish I could answer that. I'm sorry I can't. That's very interesting.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call very much. The individual battles on Saipan, I was sort of struck by this, young fellow, Frank Borta, and what they, I mean, describe the kind of situation on the island in terms of their conditions of, it's almost too hard to.
Well, you know, I think all men suffer in war, and certainly these men suffered. It's a volcanic island, so it's primarily coral, so the coral tore at their feet. They had trench foot, they had jungle rot, and they expected the battle to be over in a week, and of course it lasted 3 weeks. And Borda was in the 29th Battalion, 1st Battalion, 29th Marines, a battalion they called the Bastard Battalion, which was made up of people from all kinds of different units that had been assembled, especially for the invasion of Saipan. And they were in battle for almost the entire 3 weeks.
Yeah.
So they suffered.
Yeah. How they ever survived, how any of them ever survived is just almost beyond me. Stephen, Montreal, Wisconsin, thank you for calling. Hi.
Well, good morning. There was an incident, and I don't have the facts in front of me. In late 43 or 44, you had a group of black airmen training at Sheffield Field, Seymour, Indiana, now was then called Bacalar Air Force Base subsequently. They were officers, junior officers. They wanted to use the officers' club, and they were denied admission by the Virginia-born and raised base commander. They forced the issue and were arrested on charges of what, insubordination, I don't know what all, and were brought up on charges. And there was a time interval here, and they were, at least some of them, the charges were removed. But those officers were denied admission to the officers' club because of their race.
Huh? Yeah. Yeah, that's a very, very common story. I'm sorry to say, the black sailors who were en route from Waukegan, Illinois, Great Lakes Naval Training School to Port Chicago, obviously stopped en route to Port Chicago at restaurants en route, and they were denied entrance, even though they were fighting for our country or serving our country. They were denied entrance into restaurants. But what that incident that happened in Seymour, Indiana, I'm unfamiliar with that, but it was very, very common.
And in fact, there were several young black men who were actually beaten up or even jailed for insisting that they were Marines.
Yeah.
By other Marines. So other Marines attacked them.
Edgar Huff, who went on to become one of the most famous black Marines in Marine Corps history, he's died, but his son and I have gotten to be friends, and his son provided me with an enormous amount of material. But he was going back from Monford Point in North Carolina to visit his mother in Alabama for Christmas, and he was thrown in jail by two Marines who did not believe that the Marines had admitted black Marines, and they held him there for 4 days and beat him when at least initially.
A terrible time, but we've learned, at least the military's learned.
Yeah, I think so. In fact, the Black Marines of Monford Point are being awarded the Congressional Gold Medal this Thursday in Washington, D.C. by the Marine Corps Commandant, and they're now being called the Hidden Heroes of World War II. And it's obviously a well-deserved and long overdue award.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's still a few left, guys left from the battle for Saipan.
Yeah, there are. But as the I think our first caller said, you know, obviously they're going very fast.
Yeah.
And it obviously it's important to capture their story, get their story down before they go for the benefit of their families and all of us.
James, it's a real pleasure to be able to visit with you today. You've got a wonderful book here, and I'm sure you're out on the road now for a while, huh, to sell the book?
They turn us from writers into salesmen. We're out promoting, flogging the book.
Well, and you've got some thoughts about another book?
I do. I'm going to stay out in the National Archives and do, I hope... This time, another adventure story. This book involved a lot of research.
Yeah, it surely did, and it's beautifully written. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
James Campbell, Wisconsin native and resident, has written many award-winning articles and books. He's got three books that I've been fortunate to interview him about, and any of his books, when they come out, I'll be one of the first to call to get him in because I really enjoy reading those books. The Final Frontiersman was his first book. The Ghost Mountain Boys, the second. This book, The Color of War, How One Battle Broke Japan and Another Changed America. Great to have him with us today. And he'll be back. Unless he doesn't finish another book.
I'll be back.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, James. Well, a good history book gives you a sense of the dates, the elements, the characters that were important to an event, but a great history book really draws you into the story, makes you feel like you were actually there. And, of course, James Campbell did a wonderful job of writing that and bringing that to life for us, and sometimes in very good detail that really described, I think, what people were going through. And they had some pretty treacherous weather on top of everything else while they were in Saipan. We might not deal with the extremes that they did, but our weather can be a challenge for us, too. Coming up next, the weather guys talk about the large amounts of rain that fell on the Duluth-Superior region last week and caused such severe flooding. That's coming up next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.